As we impose tariffs against trading partners who aren't playing fair, my next guest reminds us that America's role in the global ebb and flow of goods is hardly innocent. In his new book, Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates, he recounts the scoundrels who terrorized the shipping routes in the Atlantic and Indian Oceans, unnerved the superpowers of the day, and ultimately reflected the brash of the new nation to come. Eric J. Dolan is the author and my guest. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about the pirates and the business that they did in with the colonialists, let's talk about piracy itself before that. In the 1500s, Spain and England were mortal enemies, and there was some state-sponsored piracy as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. In the 1500s, starting in the late 1400s, you know, Spain sort of took over a lot of the Western Hemisphere, and they felt that it was their domain. They also found great wealth there in the mines and mints of Central and South America, and a lot of European powers, including England, were quite jealous of all this Spanish success. So Queen Elizabeth I, the Virgin Queen, ordered one of her men, one of her sea dogs, Sir Francis Drake, to go to the Pacific Ocean and attack Spanish galleons and hopefully relieve them of their treasure so that some of the wealth that Spain had commandeered through its conquest of the West could come back into English coffers. And Sir Francis Drake did an excellent job. He overpowered and plundered a number of ships, came back to England, where he was knighted for his heroics. Mm-hmm. He wasn't treated as a pirate by the English, of course. They viewed him more as a privateer. But the Spanish, of course, viewed Sir Francis Drake's attacks as pure piracy. And in fact, at the time, England and Spain were nominally at peace. So Sir Francis Drake was more of a pirate than he was a privateer. But Queen Elizabeth was quite happy because the amount of money and treasure that he brought back was almost the equivalent of a year's worth of the income from the royal income. So it was really a great win for her, and Sir Francis Drake was treated as a knight. And it's basically true throughout history that nobody is called a pirate unless their fellow peers call them so.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is in the eye of the beholder. Sure. Depends on whose ox is being gored.
Yeah, well, yeah. One man's ceiling is another man's floor. You know, it's just the way it works. Now, a century later, the British colonial governor of Jamaica hired another famous sea captain, Henry Morgan, and turned it loose on the Spanish possessions. So I know that he was also very, very successful. And they did this, these states did this under the guise of letters of marque, if I'm saying that correctly. What is that? What were those?
Well, letters of marque are basically privateering licenses that during times of war, a government is legally allowed to issue a letter of marque to a merchant ship, an armed merchant ship, that gives them permission to go out and attack the enemies of the country during the time of war and bring back the ships that they capture and have them adjudicated at admiralty courts and actually get part of the profits from those ships and perhaps get the ship itself. So Henry Morgan was a buccaneer. He was a pirate for some time, but also he did get privateering licenses, and some of them were issued during times when Spain and England were at war. Others were issued at times when that delineation was less clear and his acts were more piratical than privateering in nature. But it's important to point out that the line between privateering and piracy is often quite thin. And many privateers veered into piracy, especially since both groups have the same set of skills.
Let's fast forward to colonial life in America in the 1600s. First of all, what was life like, let's say, for colonialists in the Northeast and Boston and like? What was the actual living conditions and the difficulties they were facing under British rule then?
Well, it was very difficult. They were on the edge of empire. Here they were hugging the coast of the American colonies, not getting a lot in the way of support from the mother country, certainly not having any representation in Parliament or the affairs of the mother country. And England really looked at their colonies, not only their American colonies, but their other colonies, as ways to enrich the central powers. Mm-hmm. So the Americans were feeling a little bit left out and condescended to. And they also had a very difficult time getting currency. We have silver and gold, and they were often forced, and they were in fact forced by the British government to pay for a lot of their goods with currency, yet the colonies were often starved of the very thing that they needed to enrich their own lives. And also the navigation laws required that all goods coming into the colonies had to first be transshipped through England, and that entailed additional customs duties. Right. And made many of the products more expensive. So it's no surprise that many American colonists, even in the late 1600s, well before the American Revolution, were feeling somewhat abused by the mother country. And they had good reason for feeling that way.
Yeah. And so they were in kind of in desperate straits. So here come the pirates now, who are kind of knocking off all of these merchant ships and other things like that. And then bringing that money and that booty to the shores of this young, early pre-country. And they were getting the money they needed. They were getting the goods they needed. And I understand from your writing that, you know, Boston and Newport had the banks with the best skilled money launderers and also some of the best prostitutes and grog houses in the world. So there were more attractions to bring in those pirates.
Yes, yes. The colonies did compete to give higher rates or fees, sort of laundering foreign money or Spanish silver dollars. And so the pirates could get more bang for the buck if they went to certain colonies. But one thing that's really important to mention in connection with the piracy that took place in the late 1600s, much of it was American ships with Americans on board, people from the colonies, going around the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean and attacking Mughal or Muslim ships coming from India that were transiting to the Red Sea and the ports of Jeddah and Mocha. And they had plenty of treasure on board. And one of the things that made it easier for Americans at the time to accept this form of piracy, even though those Red Sea men were given privateering licenses because it was during King William's War and France and England were at war, those privateering licenses were basically just covers. They were not privateers. They were pirates going into the Indian Ocean. But what they were doing is they were plundering these quote-unquote infidels or heathens halfway around the world and bringing that money back to the colonies. So the colonists, who often labeled these Red Sea men as privateers, even though they weren't, didn't have any compunction against supporting them.
Yeah.
Because they were attacking people that they looked down on anyway, and then they were bringing all this great stuff back to the colonies.
Yeah, I mean, they were the heathens. They didn't care about, yes, the heathens. They were less than human.
Right.
So they didn't really care. I mean, that kind of the way it kind of juxtaposes the fact that, you know, New England and Boston, it was really kind of very ruled by the kind of a Puritan, autocratic kind of government and morality. And yet in this case, you know, I guess they looked the other way. As a matter of fact, John Winthrop was described a 1646 visit by pirates to Plymouth as divine providence. And actually, I went online and I find they're still celebrating that today in Plymouth.
Right.
Every year they have a celebration. Yeah.
It seems throughout history, one of the things that's really fascinating about pirates and can be reflected in so many elements of American or world history is that money talks, and money often persuades people to view similar situations quite differently, depending on whether or not they're benefiting from the money,
yeah,
or they're the ones being attacked and being, mm-hmm, plundered. So the colonists really had no problem with this money. And even though perhaps it didn't square with their religious morals to some extent, they were willing to accept it. Later on in the 1700s, when it was the colonists and their interests that were being attacked by, yeah, pirates, they were singing quite a different tune. But again, greed and money determine the course of American history and world history very strongly.
Yeah, and I don't think things are much different today. As a matter of fact, we see very much the same parallels between the kind of the have and the have-nots as well.
Absolutely.
My guest is Eric J. Dolan. The book is Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. We don't have that much time, but I was interested in the surprising way in which pirate ships were governed. How did they manage their own affairs?
Well, they were largely democratic in nature, but don't confuse them with being sort of political philosophers.
Yeah.
Basically, what they did is they drew up the articles of the ship, or the pirate's code, as it was called. And in that, it would determine how the money was split. And often the money on a pirate ship was split almost equally, with the captain and the quartermaster and perhaps a medical person, if he was on board, receiving a little bit more. The pirates also had the opportunity to vote for who would be their captain, where they would go in search of prizes, and which ships they would attack.
Right.
And along with this voting ability for their captain, they also could depose a captain who they felt was not doing a good job. And that happened quite a bit. So yes, they were democratic in nature, but it was really because they were a floating society and they needed to establish rules that would make them become a cohesive, fighting and threatening force. And you have to keep in mind, many pirates mutinied on merchant ships, killed their despotic captains, took over the ship, and launched into piracy. So it makes sense that those very people who had been lorded over by one individual would not want to recreate a system on their pirate ship where there was too much power concentrated in the hands of one man. So that was in large part the reason why they voted their captains in and then voted their captains out.
Yeah.
So it is a fascinating floating society, but again, don't draw any parallels between the democratic principles that the pirates had in the early 1700s and the democratic principles for which the American Revolution, or on which the American Revolution turned.
Well, these people were ruthless. They were scoundrels. They didn't mind killing and stealing and doing what they needed to get what they wanted. So I don't think I will confuse them again by using democratic principles and opining on that. We have a lot of myths about pirates. For example, Robert Louis Stevenson in Treasure Island wrote of buried treasure. Was there ever any buried treasure?
There is no record of any pirate during the Golden Age burying their treasure. They often spent it as fast as they got it. And just think about it. If you bury a treasure, that implies that you're going to be able to get back there sometime in the future. And that was not necessarily guaranteed.
Yeah.
Also, if you buried your treasure, somebody else might find it. And they liked to keep the treasure nearby. And when they had opportunities in ports of call to spend it, they did.
Yeah, so there wasn't really a culture of saving.
No, they weren't good money managers.
No 401ks there.
Yeah, the few pirates that got a lot of money, and I have to emphasize that it was a few. It's amazing how many pirates really failed to achieve much in the way of wealth. But the few that did manage to get their hands on a lot of money often didn't do very well with it over time, if they even survived.
Not surprising. So why are we so enticed by these kinds of images, whether it's the Western gunslinger or the Prohibition-era bootlegger and the pirate? You know, we've got these dashing leading men, Errol Flynn so many years ago, and Johnny Depp today. I don't know how dashing he is, but he's different. The bottom line is, why are we so attracted to these people? Is it because they go against society?
I think that's certainly part of it. The allure of reading about people that do things that you in your own life would never even consider doing, and sort of the abstract notion of being in control of your own destiny. For a pirate, going out on the ocean, being on a ship with other men, drinking rum, plundering at will, and hopefully living a long and a fabulously wealthy life. Now, unfortunately, the reality of it was nothing like that.
Well, most pirates didn't really make any money.
Right. Oh, most pirates not only didn't make any money, they lived relatively short lives, and many of them found the end of their life at the end of a rope, being hanged.
Yeah.
So another part of it is what you mentioned, Hollywood, Errol Flynn. I mean, the leading men, the rakish rapscallions, the good-natured thieves on the ocean. Those images that we've seen in so many movies starting in the early to mid-1900s have had an indelible impact on how we view pirates. And then there's some other thing. You'd have to talk to a psychologist to get the answer to this, because I still am puzzling about it. But why do people love reading about the bad boys and girls of history, people that do horrific things,
yeah.
You know, be it a murder mystery or a war or something else, things that are really wrenching, difficult to read about, and that you probably wouldn't want to be involved in, nevertheless create such a compelling narrative that people are drawn to it. And I think pirates benefit from that to some extent. And it's exciting to dress up with a patch, an eye patch, a hook for a hand, which is another myth, and go around saying arg and matey.
What about wooden leg? Not many wooden legs, I understand.
I came across no
wooden leg.
Pirates with peg legs. However, there were men at the time, sailors, who had their legs blown off by cannons,
yeah,
that did get prosthetics that,
okay,
were in fact wooden legs,
oh, okay,
as well as claw hands.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's difficult being on a ship when you have two good legs and two good hands.
Yeah,
imagine the difficulty getting
point.
Around without that.
All right, well, the book is about pirates. It's Black Flags, Blue Waters, a great little book, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. And I think the bottom line here is to remember that money and greed, and rather than the many lofty ideals that we would like to believe shaped the expansion and the success of America, rugged individualism, things like that, which of course did exist, but equally so, or to a great degree so, money and greed also had a lot to do with that. My guest, Eric J. Dolan, and to hear this in any interview again, or if you have a question about what we've just discussed, visit our website at stevepomerantz.com to join the conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for a brief rundown of the important topics we've covered that week straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. Eric J. Dolan, thank you so much.
Thank you.